Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. We've got a few anniversaries, as always. On April 23rd, 1817, under their leader Miloš Obrenović, a group of Serbian rebels in the village of Takova declared independence from the Ottoman Empire, setting off the Second Serbian Uprising. After a conflict that lasted until late July 1817, the rebels were able to win de facto independence from the Ottomans, who recognized their autonomous state as the Principality of Serbia. The Serbs finally gained full independence at the Congress of Berlin in 1878. On April 23, 1985, in what is considered one of the most catastrophically bad business decisions of all time, the Coca-Cola Company introduced a new formula for its flagship beverage. Although the new formula had supposedly outperformed the old one in taste tests, the move was so overwhelmingly unpopular that the country revived the old formula a mere 3 months later, first as Coca-Cola Classic, and later after it had phased out the new formula as just Coca-Cola again. The switch seems so baffling that it spawned a plethora of conspiracy theories ranging from a ploy to boost sales to a cover story to disguise changes in the original formula, such as a switch from sugar to high fructose corn syrup or the removal of its remaining coca components. You take your pick. Moving on to the news, we start in the Middle East with Israel-Palestine, where satellite images appear to show the Israeli military, our IDF, advancing its preparations for the forthcoming ground assault on Rafah. According to Al Jazeera, one set of images indicates that the IDF is beginning to mass vehicles in two areas along the northern Gaza border and in the Negev Desert in southern Israel. It's also established at least 9 base facilities around the outskirts of the Gaza Strip. The upshot appears to be that the IDF is planning not just to go into Rafah, but to go in with most of its forces, presumably in hopes of achieving a quick mission accomplished moment. Meanwhile, the AP looked at another set of images that appear to show a tent city going up in Khan Yunis. This could be related to whatever plan the IDF has to try to evacuate or gesture toward evacuating civilians from Rafah ahead of the assault, though a Palestinian health official told the AP that the tents are meant to accommodate people already displaced by the IDF's handiwork. By the by, International Committee of the Red Cross Middle East Regional Director Fabrizio Carboni told AFP on Tuesday that the ICRC believes an evacuation of Rafah is not, quote-unquote, possible, given the devastation the IDF has wrought on the rest of Gaza. Carboni also said that the ICRC hasn't seen any indication of an Israeli evacuation plan, though the Wall Street Journal reported on Monday that a plan does exist. Citing Egyptian officials briefed on the Israeli plans, the Wall Street Journal reported that Israeli officials are planning for a 2 to 3 week evacuation coupled with a slow move into Rafah. It's unclear how the Israelis intend to provide humanitarian support for the evacuees, given that the vast majority of the aid that comes into Gaza passes through Rafah. The U.S. military says it's planning to start construction on its Gaza Pier project soon, so I guess there's some possibility that could play a role here, assuming that it all actually works. The United Nations is calling for an investigation into reports of mass graves unearthed on the campuses of Shifa Hospital in Gaza City and Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. The IDF has besieged and raided both of those locations twice, I believe, in the case of Shifa, since October 7th. Israeli officials have said their forces killed militants who were allegedly using those facilities, but witnesses have relayed details of mass summary executions that may be borne out by the discovery of these mass graves. Israeli officials reject those allegations and the allegation that they dug these mass graves. They insist that their forces merely exhumed bodies that had already been buried to see if any of them were Israelis who'd been taken hostage on October 7th. Any thorough investigation would require a ceasefire, so there's little chance of that happening. And in the West Bank, Israeli forces killed at least one Palestinian and wounded two others in a raid in the West Bank city of Jericho and nearby refugee camps on Tuesday. There's no indication that any of the casualties were combatants. In Iraq, Iraqi officials now believe that a mysterious explosion that rocked a militia base in Babil province overnight Friday into Saturday, which I wrote about in Friday's newsletter, was caused by munitions stored at that facility. Given the broader regional circumstances, there has been speculation that the blast was the result of an Israeli or less likely U.S. drone strike, but the Iraqis claim that there were no aircraft, including drones, in the area at the time. The blast killed one person and wounded several others. In Lebanon, the IDF and Hezbollah exchanged fire across the Israeli-Lebanese border several times on Tuesday. In particular, Hezbollah launched a drone strike against two IDF bases near Acre that marks its deepest attack into Israeli territory since October 7th. That strike came in response to an IDF attack earlier in the day that killed one Hezbollah fighter. After the Acre strike, the IDF carried out an airstrike on the southern Lebanese village of Hanin that reportedly killed two civilians and prompted Hezbollah to fire a barrage of rockets into northern Israel. In Iran, the Biden administration on Tuesday blacklisted four individuals and two entities allegedly tied to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' cyber command. Federal prosecutors also announced that they're charging the four individuals over what Reuters called, quote, an alleged multi-year cyber campaign targeting more than one dozen American companies, end quote. Most of the targeted companies were defense contractors. Moving on to Asia and Armenia, the Armenian government's decision to hand four disputed border villages over to Azerbaijan, which we covered in Friday's newsletter, seems to have borne some tangible fruit in the form of actual progress on demarcating the nebulous Armenian-Azerbaijani border. Officials from both countries actually installed a border marker on Tuesday, essentially working off of Soviet provincial maps. Border disputation is one of the biggest single sore spots in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relationship. An Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev responded to the demarcation on Tuesday by proclaiming that a bilateral peace deal is now, quote, close as never before, end quote. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan is taking heat for the village transfer, however. Critics have accused him of trading the strategically important villages for the diplomatic equivalent of magic beans in the form of vague promises from Aliyev about advancing peace talks. Tuesday's demarcation news might quiet some of that criticism, though I doubt it will silence the critics completely. Aliyev doesn't have a sterling track record among Armenians for obvious reasons, so his public optimism is unlikely to reassure many people in Yerevan. In Myanmar, the unspecified sources within the Myanmar military are telling AFP that their forces have reoccupied a military outpost in the border town of Miawadi that they had abandoned to rebels earlier this month. There's no confirmation of this, and assuming it's true, no indication as to how they got back into the town, and the rebel Karen National Union apparently hasn't commented. Myanmar forces have been trying to retake Miawadi, a major commercial crossing point along the Thai border, via airstrikes and reinforcements on the ground. In China, there's a piece of foreign policy by Gabriel Collins and Stephen Miles from Rice University, where they cite indications that the Biden administration may be trialing a major shift in U.S. energy policy. Let me read you the introduction to their piece. A low-profile post by the U.S. Department of Energy may point to a serious strategic change in U.S. policy in trade, energy, and relations with China. So far, the notice has received little or no public coverage or attention despite its potential ramifications, but combined with other legislative and political signals, it could be a game-changer in the energy landscape. The White House and DOE announced on January 26, 2024, a temporary pause in reviewing applications to export liquefied natural gas, or LNG, to countries with which the U.S. does not have a free trade agreement. The Natural Gas Act requires the DOE to approve applications for the export of LNG to non-free trade agreement countries unless the DOE finds that the export would, quote, not be consistent with the public interest, end quote. In its January 26th announcement, the DOE emphasized that the factors it would consider were the same that, quote, DOE has considered when evaluating the public interest of LNG exports for more than a decade, end quote, namely domestic natural gas prices, economic impact, energy security for the U.S. and its allies, and environmental factors with an extra dose of climate consciousness. Save for climate, these are longstanding metrics for determining the NGA's public interest standard. But on February 23rd, the DOE posted a new notice to explain the temporary pause. It was similar to the January 26th announcement, save for the last paragraph. There, the DOE suggested one outcome of its pause in issuing new LNG export permits could be to take steps to reduce the risks to consumers and manufacturers caused, quote, by selling our energy resources to competitor countries that don't align with our interests and those of our allies, end quote. The only potential LNG buying nation that fits that description is the People's Republic of China. China doesn't import much U.S. LNG right now, but Chinese firms, according to this piece, and I'm quoting here, account for almost 25% of the volume. That's a quote of long-term U.S. LNG export contracts. So this temporary pause could be the prelude to something bigger and much more permanent in terms of a change in policy. Moving on to Africa and Sudan, the Sudanese military says its air defense has prevented a drone strike on its base in the northeastern Sudanese city of Shendi on Tuesday. Sudanese military commander Abdel Fattah al-Burhan was apparently in that area on Tuesday, but it's unclear whether the Rapid Support Forces group was targeting him specifically. The RSF has attempted drone strikes against military positions in parts of eastern Sudan on a few occasions in recent months. It never claims responsibility, but it's not like there are any other suspects. But none of them have been particularly extensive or successful. In Mali, the U.S. State Department on Tuesday blacklisted seven senior figures within the al-Qaeda-aligned Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin group, while the Treasury Department blacklisted two additional JNIM members. Several were targeted specifically for their involvement in hostage-taking, and even more specifically for taking U.S. nationals hostage. Since I'm assuming none of these targeted people have significant assets in the U.S. and that none of them were planning to spend their summer vacation in the U.S., these actions are mostly symbolic. The sanctions do also prohibit U.S. nationals from dealing with the targeted individuals. In Ethiopia, the UN says that some 50,000 people have been displaced by quote-unquote armed clashes in the Tigray region's southern zone over the past 2 weeks. It's unclear who exactly is clashing. Amhara Regional Security Forces occupied that area during the Ethiopian government's war with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, and they may still be there, even though it's long past the deadline for those forces to have withdrawn. Like Tigray's western zone, this is an area over which the Amhara and Tigray have overlapping claims. In Europe, in Russia, a Russian court on Tuesday rejected Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich's latest appeal of his March 2023 arrest on spying charges. Gershkovich's lawyers were challenging the Russian government's latest extension of his pretrial detention period, which now runs through at least June 30th. Russian officials have suggested on several occasions that they would be willing to release Gershkovich as part of another prisoner exchange with the U.S., but only after his trial, a trial that they have repeatedly postponed. In Ukraine, the Russian military has reportedly seized another village in Ukraine's Donetsk Oblast. Officials in Moscow, as well as Russian bloggers, are claiming that Russian forces moved into Ocheretinye on Sunday. Sorry if I'm mangling that. That village is located northwest of Avdiivka and due east of the city of Pokrovsk, an important Ukrainian logistical hub. Perhaps more significantly, its capture suggests that the Russians have breached the defensive line the Ukrainians tried to establish after pulling out of Avdiivka back in February. It opens a second line of advance in addition to the Russian push on the town of Chasiv Yar to the north. The Ukrainian government announced on Tuesday that it will no longer perform consular services for fighting age, that's anywhere from 18 to 60 years old, Ukrainian men who are living abroad, unless, of course, they're interested in returning to Ukraine. The aim is undoubtedly to ensure that Ukrainian authorities have updated military registration documents for those men in concert with their new mobilization law. In the Americas, in Haiti, police are reportedly scrambling to try to secure the area around the National Palace in Port-au-Prince by Wednesday, when that facility is scheduled to be the site where the members of Haiti's new transitional council are sworn into office. Insurgents control most of that area at this point, but Haitian authorities are insisting on using the palace because they feel it will demonstrate that they, not the gangs, are in charge, all available evidence to the contrary. In the United States, by an overwhelming majority, the U.S. Senate on Tuesday night approved the version of Joe Biden's $95 billion supplemental military aid package that was approved over the weekend by the U.S. House of Representatives. This includes funding for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, along with a possible U.S. ban on the social media app TikTok. Biden will presumably be signing it into law any minute now, after which the U.S. military will likely get moving on its first major new tranche of Ukrainian military assistance in several months. And finally, Tom Dispatch's Tom Engelhart, just a couple of months shy of his 80th birthday, happy birthday, happy early birthday to him, ponders our American gerontocracy and what it implies. Let me read you a bit of his piece. I mean, the country that still passes for the greatest power on planet Earth is going to set a limping age record for president no matter who wins, leaving China's Xi Jinping now 70 and Russia's Vladimir Putin now 71 as relative youths in an all-American world of absolute ancientness. And that should certainly tell you something about the state of our country and this planet, too. To be a little clearer about just what, let me add one more factor to the equation. Joe Biden and Donald Trump are preparing a fight to the wire to lead an America that not so many decades ago, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, was considered the sole superpower on planet Earth. Doesn't that tell you something? I think it does. I think, quite bluntly, though I've seen no one discussing this amid the endless media headlines and chatter about Trump and Biden, that these two old codgers offer a stunning image of the all-too-literal decline and fall of, yes, the United States. They should make us consider where the country that still likes to think of itself as the singularly most powerful and influential one on this planet is really heading. And you can click through and read the rest of that piece. On that note, though, that's all for us tonight. Happy Passover to anybody who is celebrating. And thanks for reading and or listening to the newsletter, especially thanks to those of you who are Foreign Exchange's subscribers. And until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.